And joining us now from the wilds of Maryland, which I'm still enjoying reading about in the novel Chesapeake, Doug Greenwald from Preserving Bible Times. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Boy, I'm learning more about your history out there and the battle between the churches and the issue of slavery and how Maryland became a border state, and I'm just learning a whole bunch. Makes me want to read some more. I'm waiting for Michener's next novel. I guess I'm going to have to wait a long time, huh?
Well, wait till you get to the crab soup part. I think that's the best crab part soup? Of the book.
Is that the best part? The whole Chesapeake environment there. Yeah, could be. Doug, it's Advent season, and we anticipate some great historical and cultural context to kind of flesh out that whole story. We have kind of a slanted view of the whole thing, don't we? Kind of a greeting card view of the Advent.
Yeah, sometimes I think it's one-dimensional at best.
Well, I still picture Joseph and Mary on that gentle donkey with Mary perched on top and the star leading them into Bethlehem. It's kind of an odd picture. It has nothing to do with reality, but that's kind of what we're left with from the commercial side of Christmas, isn't it?
Well, we'll have to wait a couple of weeks before we get to that part because we want to deal with Zachariah and Elizabeth first, who sort of set the stage for that event. But, Advent is really about Luke 1, and so that's where we'll spend most of our time today. But I wonder if I can ask you a riddle first.
Well, but kind of put us on the spot. You know, we're not used to being, but we're used to putting our guests on the spot. But so be
it. No one has ever answered this one, so feel badly if you miss it.
David, we have a mountain to climb.
Can I Google it? Can I Google the answer?
You can Google this one, but I'm not sure what you're going to find.
Okay. All right.
David is the fastest Googler in the whole Midwest. I just think you should know that. It's amazing how quick he is with answers. So let's hear the riddle and see what we can do. David, you ready?
Yeah, okay, here's the fingers riddle. I'm going to do a riddle in place of a quote this morning. Somebody left home, turned left, turned left again, and turned left one more time, and arrived home with two more people. What's just happened?
Oh. Woo-hoo. Well, he went in a circle and got back to where he started. Well, we don't know that, but he turned left, left, and left, came back with two more people.
Yep.
No one's ever answered it here. We could be the first, David.
Can we put
We can talk about this. You know, this is like clock's on. We can talk to each other. What do you think? Not Jesus and the first two disciples, probably. It's not. Wait a minute. There's a clue he gave us. He said we're starting with Zechariah and Elizabeth.
That's going to be a stretch of a clue.
Oh, but okay.
To save you some time in your deliberations, I'm going to give you a key word. Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll call this a contextual word that goes with the riddle. Baseball.
Ooh, that's okay. He ran around the bases. Is left, and left, and then you arrive back home, and you with two more with him. It was a home run after with two guys on base.
Bingo!
Aha.
Free trip to Bemidji.
Oh, right.
Well, Bemidji's a pretty cool place, literally.
Now,
getting cooler all every day.
Yeah.
You see the significance of one word?
I do.
One word of context just takes a puzzle and everything quickly falls into place. And when we read the scriptures, the gospel writers, all the biblical writers for that matter, but since we're dealing with Advent here, the gospel writers give us key words that just open up a whole new world of context. It's going to take us maybe 20 minutes to get there, but the key word for the beginning part of Luke 1 is the word barren. Okay, so
B-A-R-R-E-N.
That's right.
Okay.
When we approach Advent, particularly as we see it as Luke develops in Luke 1 and a little bit of Luke 2 here, the motif is one of waiting. Advent is the season of waiting. We find that the nation is waiting for God to get rid of these Romans who have been in this land almost six centuries now, coming in 63 BC with Pompey and the Roman 10th Legion. Rome is the kingdom of evil in the eyes of the Jews. And when Rome came in, he ended the Hasmonean dynasty, which was ruling over this land, And that was for almost 100 years where Jews were governing Jews again. You know, not since David and Solomon had Jews govern Jews in this land. And when Judas the Maccabee started his revolt in 167 BC, and it finally got consolidated, and the whole area was brought under Jewish control again, and the Hasmoneans in like 150 BC began to rule, it was a real bonanza, so to speak, in the eyes of the Jews, because finally Jews were governing Jews again. And that ended in 63 BC when Rome invaded this land and conquered it, and they have been under Rome's oppression ever since. And so part of the waiting motif here is the nation is waiting.
Now, last week, Doug, you mentioned a kind of a 70-year time period, and we talked briefly about how the culture itself was kind of in a state of anticipation that something was going to happen here. Does that pertain?
That's the restoration of the temple on the 70-year cycle, which goes back from 586 BC to 516 BC when the temple was rebuilt after the return of Ezra and Nehemiah. And that's a part of this as well. There's waiting, but a little bit with building expectation that perhaps in another 12 years or so, something profound will happen. When we get to Luke 2, we find Anna, who's waiting and has been waiting a long, long time. We find Simeon, and he's been waiting a long, long time. And in Luke 1, we run across this couple named Zechariah and Elizabeth, who have been waiting for, it seems, 30, 35, maybe even 40 years for the birth of a son that never came. And now it seems as if they're waiting in vain. And so I just want to bring that big umbrella motif to this Luke 1 Advent discussion here. Advent is about waiting, and it's waiting with unfulfilled longings. The nation is waiting with unfulfilled longings. Zechariah and Elizabeth are waiting with unfulfilled longings. Same with Simeon and Anna. And this motif of waiting with unfulfilled longings is the motif of Advent. And all of us, truth be known, are waiting for something. Still, that seems so good and so right, but has never yet quite showed up in our lives. And so that's the backdrop that I would just like to put in place here as we start to launch into Luke's first chapter.
And it reminds me a little bit of not to diverge too much from what you're saying here, but Internet Monk today, Chaplain Mike, talking about life being spent in between. We're always in a state of where we've been and where we want to be. And I'm not sure if you ever feel like you get there. It's part, and the same feeling is what you're communicating to me about that culture at that time.
And I think part of the genius of Luke here is he sees that theme under the inspiration of the Spirit. And that's what makes Advent common to every person I know. We're all waiting for something still with unfulfilled longings because life just hasn't turned out like we hoped and dreamed it would. Whether it's divorce or cancer or the birth of a child with disabilities or long-term unemployment, the list can go on and on and on. Barrenness, singleness. There always seems to be this issue of we're waiting with unfulfilled longings for something so good and so right that just never seems to come our way. And that's why I think this couple, Zechariah and Elizabeth, who epitomizes this waiting where life didn't turn out like they hoped and dreamed it would, is really our story as well. It's the universal theme of Luke and his first chapter here. And so I think the journey we're about to take here with Zechariah and Elizabeth is just about the journey of every one of us in some way, shape, or form. And I think that will help us to identify with this text.
Now, barrenness had a greater significance in that time and culture than it does now. Isn't that true?
Well, it sure did, but let's hold that back for two verses because we want to unfold this in the way that Luke does, starting in his fifth verse here, where he starts out in the day of Herod. That reminds us of Rome. Herod's the puppet king of Rome, king of Judea. There was a priest named Zacharias. And if we start to put a little bit of the arithmetic together here, it would seem that this priest we have run across, named Zacharias, was born fairly near the time that Rome entered this land. We do not know the name of Zechariah's father, but there was a time, a day, when he was waiting for his wife to give birth. We don't know the name of Zechariah's father. It could have been the same name that was often common in this culture. But that particular day, he would have heard the cry of a newborn baby. And before the midwife could come out to tell him whether it was a daughter or a son, he had high hopes that it would be a son, because he's a priest, and only priests can give birth to future priests. And so he was hopeful that he would be blessed by God with the birth of a son who would be a priest to carry on in his tradition. And when the midwife came out and said, "It's the son," he had to have been overjoyed. And with that news, he had a new task on his plate. He had to find a name for this son. And naming is really significant in this culture. I think sometimes we lose sight of that. When we think back of Abraham, his name was the father of many. When we think of Moses, his name means God draws out. When we think of Elijah, his name means my God is Jehovah. And so as Zechariah's father looked across this land, naming was a sacred and a solemn task. And finally, he was led to say, "I'm going to give him the name Zacharias," which means whom Jehovah remembers. And it's a name that harkens back almost 500 years in the history of this land to Zechariah, who we run across in the Minor Prophets, who is probably the most prophetic of all the Minor Prophets, speaking to the coming of Messiah. And so now this newborn son had a name, Zacharias, that he was going to go through life with. It was a name he would never forget, the meaning of which he would never forget. And that meaning is whom Jehovah remembers.
I'm cogitating here. I never thought about going back to the father of Zechariah. And you know, cuz the clues aren't there, but that's the pattern that it followed. Father, son, and the son was an extension of the father. Much more so than we see now in today's culture. So having a son and having him carry on in your vocation, in this case the priesthood, was a critical sort of thing, wasn't it?
It was, and part of the naming in this culture is that you were expected to grow into the meaning of your name. And so the irony here is that Zechariah's name means whom Jehovah remembers. And as he goes further and further and further through his life, he's going to wonder more and more whether God has actually forgotten him. We'll pick that theme up a little bit later, but it ties to the significance of your name. And I suspect all through his youth, his father would remind him again of the day he was born, why he chose that particular name. And for this Zechariah, the meaning of his name, whom God remembers, would have been embossed in his soul and engraven on his heart, whom Jehovah remembers. Well, anyway, as a father, naming is just where your responsibilities start. And so I don't know how many years it took, but it wouldn't have been too many more years longer when this Zechariah's father would have said, "You know, I've been blessed with a special son. I need to find him a special wife." And not just any wife. It had to be a wife from another priestly family, because priests had to marry priests to give birth to more priests. That's how the ordinary priesthood sustained itself. And so I don't know, Zechariah may have been age 7, age 8, age 9, age 10, but one day Zechariah's father came home and said to Zechariah's mother, "Such a deal I have done today. I have found him a wife. Her name is going to be Elizabeth. She is from the priestly line of Aaron himself. And she has a fantastic name, whom God loves." And so he felt that he had found the perfect bride for his son. And so now they await the wedding. It could have been 3 or 4 years hence, but there came a day when there was this wedding, when Zechariah was actually married to Elizabeth. And then in that multi-day wedding feast, I'm sure everyone there had high hopes for this child who was now married to this perfectly named wife, Elizabeth. because she was from the daughters of Aaron, and everyone would have said, of course there will be many, many children. Of course there will be many sons. Of course there will be many new priests born in this family. Because when God looks upon you with favor, as obviously he is doing with this young couple, then they are bearing her womb will be fruitful and they will have many children. And therein lies a pretty good lesson for all of us. The moment you define your expectation, you may well have set in motion your disappointments.
Was Elizabeth's name significant? Is it? I know it's a male-dominated culture, was then, and that the history we have was written from a male perspective, and that. But the name Elizabeth, does it have a specific meaning? And I'm thinking of Beth as a Hebrew word. What does it mean? House? As in Bethlehem is house
and
of bread.
Bethlehem, yeah. And Elizabeth's name does have a very precise meaning. It means one who swears by God. Okay. One who pledges allegiance to God. So, yeah, that's a pretty powerful meaning to her name as well.
And that probably had a lot to do with her being a Levite, I imagine, being conferred with that name.
Yes, and it, you know, when you come from the strain of Aaron, you really have special status in this culture, the Aaronic priesthood, Aaron being the first priest of the nation. She would have been viewed as a very, very special wife, a prize almost, if you will, in this culture.
And it was a culture of arranged marriages. We should emphasize that as well. So it was really Zechariah's father's responsibility, not only to himself and his family, but to the priesthood, to make sure that there was an appropriate union there.
And this was a union between two priestly families, which is how the tradition maintains itself. You can only be a priest if your mother came from the priestly line, as well as your father. Well, then we're told here that Zechariah, or in the fifth verse here, is of the division of Abiah. And that means we need to remember here that there are up to 20,000 ordinary priests in this culture, 20,000 Zechariahs, if you will. They were organized into 24 divisions. And when you do the arithmetic, that puts about 800 priests per clan or per division. And each division is then broken down into subgroupings. And so because there's so many priests, you only serve once every 24 weeks for 1 week in the temple in Jerusalem, and then you're off duty. So twice a year, Zechariah would go to Jerusalem to participate for a week in the priesthood, in the ordinances, in the sacrifices, in the incense offerings. They're part of the infrastructure of the temple. And then he's off duty for another 3 weeks. So now that they're married, after year one, after year two, after year three, no children. After year four, after year five, after year six, no children. And after a while, you say, well, these things can take time. Actually, we know of some couples who took several years before they became pregnant. But remember, this is a culture that says, if God looks upon you with favor, you will have a fruitful womb. So 7 years, 8 years, 9 years, I don't know when it would have been, but there comes a moment in time here when there's sort of an implicit line drawn in the sand, when if you're barren, it is God's evident judgment that he does not like you. You are not viewed with his favor.
And what would that mean to a priest?
Well, it's just a double whammy, if you will. And we're going to pick up that theme a little bit later here from the priestly perspective, because as we see, every year, twice a year, Zechariah goes to the temple in Jerusalem, and he's never chosen for the incense offering. Year after year, decade after decade, he is overlooked. And so it may have been in this culture that they said, oh, your wife is barren and you're never chosen for the incense offering by lot. God really doesn't like you. Now, the significance here is this. This culture is all about honoring God. And if they are convinced that God doesn't like you, they are not going to like you either. And so I think what we fail to grasp here is that after 8 or 10 years, this couple is suddenly on the outside looking in on a culture. They're suddenly starting to be ostracized. People are projecting onto them, God doesn't like you. You've done something to offend God. We know that because you're barren. Pretty heavy duty stuff.
No sympathy.
Oh, absolutely none, because it's all about honoring God. And if God doesn't like you, why should we?
Does that say that mercy and forgiveness were alien to this culture?
Well, that's a whole other theme, but yes, one of the things that's happened in this culture in the first century is mercy is missing to people who are not like you. That's a whole other theme, that's a whole other day, but that's a real backdrop to the whole gospel period. And that's why Jesus exercises so much compassion for people who have been systematically deprived of it in this culture. Well, we've gotten through verse 5 here, and then verse 6, and they were both righteous in the sight of God. So we know, Luke is telling us here, they've done nothing to offend God. They are righteous. They are rightly related to God in God's sight, and they are walking blamelessly. And that's a present tense verb. It doesn't mean they used to walk blamelessly. It means they not only did they used to, but they still are in the commandments and the requirement of the Lord. And so when we get through verse 6, everything adds up. It's a good storyline. Things are going well. But then in verse 7, Luke just shocks us when he says, but they had no children because Elizabeth was barren and they were both advanced in years. And to the observant Jewish mind of Jesus' day, this cannot be. You cannot be righteous and be barren. That's just the way the system works. We all know that's the way the system works. And so if you're barren, don't try to fool me with your righteousness. We know you've offended God. Pretty heavy burden to carry.
Well, life is about to change for them here.
Well, yes, but after a long, long period of time, I don't know whether it's 25 years, 30 years, or 35 years before conception is going to take place here. But just stay with that thought for a moment. What is it like to walk around for 20 or 25 or 30 years knowing that you're walking blamelessly and yet the culture says, we know you've offended God? And every time, every day that Elizabeth contemplates going out to the well to get some water, all the other women in the village look out their door and say, oh, there goes Elizabeth. She thinks she's righteous, but we know differently. And when it's Passover and the clan gets together and all the little kids are running around saying, Abba, Abba, there's no one running around saying, Abba, Abba, for Zechariah, and his clan looks at him and said, what have you done to offend God? And so part of the issue that we're dealing with here is you can be misunderstood in your religious culture, and there are many situations where you can't do anything about it. In fact, there's a corollary here. Most of the real pains that come our way, emotional pains, come from our religious culture. They don't come from the world.
It comes from knowing that we're not right with God in some way, that there is an issue that we need to deal with. And in their case, Zechariah in particular, as a priest, that must have been incredibly stressful, tension.
Well, actually, perplexing. I think it's the other way around. People would project onto you that there's something you need to deal with, but the truth of the matter, there isn't anything there. That's where the misunderstanding is.
But wouldn't you question yourself and try to find the answer to this? How can this be? This is a contradiction in what he knows of life.
And that's a great observation, and it leads to the question, how many times over the dinner table did the conversation shift to, Elizabeth, might there be something we've done wrong that we don't know and understand? Is it possible? And all that self-searching and self-wonderment and self-doubt. And yet, Luke is very clear here, they're walking blamelessly in the eyes of the Lord.
And there's an old philosophical corollary here that if you encounter a contradiction in life, contradictions by definition can't exist. Therefore, you question your premises, your assumptions. They must have been doing that constantly.
Well, and the culture was certainly encouraging them to do that, and that's part of the burden that they carry here. And you see it when we go ahead in Luke's first chapter here. In the 24th and 21st verse, and after these days, Elizabeth, his wife, became pregnant, and she kept herself in seclusion for 5 months, saying, this is the way the Lord has dealt with me in the days when he looked upon me with favor to take away my disgrace amongst men. And other translations have it amongst men. And so this woman lived with shame being projected on her for, I'm guessing, the better part of 20 or 25 years. And here's a woman who is centered in God's will. She just doesn't know it yet. And so going forward a little bit here, in verse 8, suddenly things shift. And Luke tells us that one day, when Zacharias was performing his priestly service before God in the appointed order of his division, the Abiyah, according to the custom of the priestly office, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn the incense. Now, I need to explain this lot casting process just a little bit here. Down in the bottom of Temple Mount was a big chamber called the Chamber of Hewn Stone. And every morning, all the priests from the particular division and clan who was on service that particular day would stand in a big circle, probably a circle of 100 to 120 priests. The president of that clan or division would be in the center, and he would take his turban off, and he would ask all the priests to raise a digit, a finger, and then he would walk over to one of the priests and take off their turban and announce a number, let's say 87. And so starting with the priest who had his turban taking off, he would count one, and then the next one to him would be two, and they would go around the circle until they got to 87, and that 87th priest was the priest who would serve that day. That's how the lot casting system worked. Well, it appears as if for at least a couple of decades, Zechariah was always a part of that process, and he was never chosen. Because he's on the eve, I think, of retiring from the priesthood here. You could only serve for 30 years as an ordinary priest. And cycle after cycle, time after time, other priests are chosen, but not him. You can only serve once, because this is such an honored task to be able to do the incense offering, that young priests come in and take the place of older priests who've been chosen. And after a while, Zechariah is probably the only graybeard in the group, with younger and younger priests coming in, all of which would point to the fact that, how come I'm never chosen? And it would add to the point that you've made as to maybe we really did do something to offend God here. And so one day, I suspect this is he's within a year or two of his retirement, he is chosen. And maybe we ought to finish up our reflection here for this particular session and pick that thought up next week.
That would be a big day in his life, then.
Well, a big day, a scary day. Maybe I'm now about to find out when I go into the holy place what we've done to offend God. I would think there's a great bit of trepidation that comes with his selection. Let's call it mixed ambivalence, if you will. Is this good news or is this bad news? Am I about to be honored or am I about to meet my comeuppance?
Now, this is all from the book of Luke, as you have mentioned, and you've also told us that Luke tends to write in chronological fashion. So do we know then that Elizabeth was already pregnant at this point?
No. In fact, when we start to read the story here, he has to return, and he's going to return both deaf and dumb, mute, and then they're going to get together and be intimate, and she will conceive. So no, at this moment in time, he's about
later.
To get the prophecy mm-hmm. that he will have a son, but he has not yet entered the holy place to do the incense offering, to meet the angel, and perhaps we should pick that up next week at that point.
I think that would be an excellent idea. So next Wednesday, we'll have chapter 2 in this Advent series with Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. Terrific teaching, just expanding our understanding, and not only that, expanding what we expect from Scripture as well. As we know, there's so much more there than most of us have ever been exposed to. And so that makes it an adventure. And Doug, we appreciate your being here. I want to emphasize your website and your ministry, and Preserving Bible Times is a ministry based in the Washington, D.C. area, and offers tremendous resources for your church, for your Bible studies, for your small group sessions, or just for your own intellectual interest. And I would recommend a visit to that website, preservingbibletimes.org. And you can link to them, if you'd like, right from the Broken Road website. It's over on the right side of the homepage there. You'll see Preserving Bible Times. You click on that, and you'll find yourself right in the midst of a world of resources. Doug, we appreciate your visit. And I should give David. David's been so quiet today. David, have you been pondering over there? You usually have a last-minute question here.
I usually have a last-minute question, but I have no questions today. I mean, it's very interesting.
Okay.
Thank you, Doug.
We will continue this next week. Doug Greenwald, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Music now on a Broken Road Radio, Winsome and Welcoming Wednesday from the Letterman.